principle-based thinking. What is my story of the future? Why do I believe it, right? I know that fundamentally, if we can create a predictable way to create small molecule medicines for as many pathways as possible, if I can get DCs declared in 12 to 18 months that have the highest probability of biology engagement and safety in humans, that is something that is really great for the world.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Today, we have Margot Georgiadis, an accomplished leader in business and technology. She is currently the CEO of Montai Health and CEO partner at Flagship Pioneering. Margot brings a rich tapestry of experiences. Her journey spans from her transformative leadership at Ancestry.com to influential roles at Google and McKinsey. Margot is an innovator and fearless leader. Embracing change, Margot transitioned from conventional business roles to the vibrant world of health technology. She focuses on using data and AI to reshape patient care, especially in managing chronic diseases. Margot blends computational power with healthcare to revolutionize disease prediction and treatment. In this episode, we discuss digitization and the role of AI in disease management, as well as the importance of innovative thinking in driving significant changes in health technology. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome, Margot. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I've been looking forward for our conversation. You have such a really interesting journey and so glad to see that you are dabbling into the healthcare now. But tell us about your journey that takes you where you are, because you have done a lot outside healthcare.
Yes, so thank you. I definitely am a little bit of a non-traditional healthcare leader, but hopefully the journey will connect the dots. I really started out in my earliest days, even college, data and systems thinking obsessed. And so I won't declare myself a dinosaur for the younger listeners here, but back in the day when it was really about statistical modeling and we did all of our compute with cards, but I was really obsessed about how do you think about building ecosystem models that help you track and understand data in complex ecosystems so you could make decisions more efficiently and gain learning velocity. And so in those early days, the application that I focused on was as an economist. So how do you think about the macro and micro policies, particularly in developing economies, when you think about food pricing, input pricing, and things like that? And in the developing world, right, if you don't do that right, the government goes down. So it's pretty existential to get these models right and to think about those secondary macro micro intersections. And then I made the decision, as I was moving into an academic career, that I really wanted to focus on broader applications. And so then I moved and spent a long time as a partner at McKinsey, applying this thinking across different types of industries. In the food industry, reshaping decisions from farm to table. Then in retail, think about applications like category management. How do you think about fast fashion and optimizing your inventory decisions across markets so you have a super efficient business model? Or just things like customer relationship management, right? How do you acquire, develop, and retain the right customers in industries like financial services, telecom, where there's highly complex networks of how do you get the right customers? How do you bring them through an experience in a network? And also, as you can imagine, payers, right? Hospitals, all those had applications. And then, you know, the next big step in my journey was to move from doing this modeling and all these different companies to actually leading a company and transforming it using this thinking. And so that's when I really broke out and went into financial services. At that time, it was one of the most data-rich industries where you had this enormous amount of collected data. And when you created these knowledge networks and use that to reimagine how do you define your products, your services, your experiences, so that you optimize your business economics. So we turned that company around and took it public. And the products that we put as the lead and the changes we made you know, are still those that drive the company today. I then went to Google. As you can imagine, that's the biggest place building platform data networks, and did that over and over when you think about desktop search to mobile search to display to video, right? And how do you enable those ecosystems to flourish with infrastructure like cloud computing, Chrome, right, and all these other support ecosystems. And then my next big transition step was to become a CEO and build companies using these capabilities in new areas. And so that's what really led me into healthcare as a leader, because it was one of the biggest areas that had not yet been digitized. And I think when you come from other industries where you've seen these types of transitions multiple times, you really understand the pattern recognition.
And so oftentimes people always, you know, come from different technology and go to healthcare, that because, you know, healthcare always seems so clunky and so old and so highly regulated. It's always the last one to innovate, like you're saying, digitizing. What are the things that you surprise you?
Yeah, so I think probably the tipping point for me was when I was the CEO of Ancestry. And we had built up these really strong machine learning models to really connect between people's family health history and their genomics and to do risk predictions of diseases. And even during the pandemic, we built the largest live research study that included people's fully integrated data, other medications they were taking, other health risk factors, other data, so that we could predict the drivers of who was most likely to be more severely affected. Or not. And how do we get underneath that and collaborate, right, with the people developing therapies and treatments? And as I developed both the COVID and then we did additional types of modeling, I was so surprised looking at the life sciences industry that for many diseases, the best therapies are really when you're in a very severe stage of disease. And the vast majority of the funding was focused on that area. But yet, as consumers or even physicians, we would prefer healthcare versus sick care. So the more we can actually predict and understand, right, the likelihood of or the early onset of that disease, the earlier we can intervene, the better. Yet that is not really where the therapeutic paradigm was focused because of the complexity of clinical trials and the cost and the regulatory environment. And so a few of us started trying to hatch an idea of how could we, if we wanted to get more therapies, especially in these large chronic diseases, which is one of the biggest societal problems we face, more efficiently, how could we think differently about using technology to do that? And we came up with some ideas. I was working with Flagship Pioneering, and we hacked together some ideas of what we could do using compute to transform the development of therapies that we thought would be safer for long-term use and early intervention. And like all startups, you have a hypothesis, you gather the data, you usually start with public data to see is this a hypothesis hold, and then you validate it doing dry lab, wet lab cycles. And you know, we realized that this actually was a scalable, completely new way in which you could pursue this. And that's what we're doing. And we're really excited about the potential to make some leaps in terms of how do we think about this. Obviously, as you said, it's a highly regulated process for a good reason. We're giving things to people, putting them in their bodies, and especially chronically. We have to pass all those thresholds, and the safety and all those other things are essential, right, for success. But, you know, we believe we have a way of doing that that can improve the predictability and the success ratios from what we've been seeing historically.
And is it because, tell me more about what you said through the computation, how has that changed to how we approach in trying to solve this particular problem in the chronic disease area?
Yeah, so I, you know, to me, it's never about the technology, it's about the problem that you're trying to solve, you know. So in our case, we said, let's start with the patient need, as we started with therapies with the potential to slow or even halt the progression of disease, that are safe for long-term use and earlier intervention, and that we can deliver them to a consumer cost-effectively in a consumer-friendly form factor, right? A pill or topical or something you would inhale, which is essentially a small molecule medicine. Okay, so then how do you solve that problem with technology? So first thing we got to do is we start with the biology that's validated underlying these diseases. So we're not using compute to try to discover the next pathway. It's certainly something we can do as we build our network over time. But we're really starting with the fact that there's 30 years of well-validated knowledge around the pathways that underlie many of these. And we're starting with inflammatory and autoimmune diseases, although our platform actually has been demonstrated across 80 mechanisms of action in 5 therapeutic areas. And then we take that knowledge of biology, and then we start with a privileged set of chemistry. And this is molecules that we know are safe when chronically consumed in a human body. So these are things from our food, herbs, medical, ancient medical traditions, things that we know consumers have safely consumed over long periods of time. So I think about it as, you know, chronic disease is a problem, a modern mismatch of the changes in our lifestyles and diets. How do we solve that with the power of human co-evolution, which is molecules that we know, right, are adapted to the human body. The human body knows how to process them. And then really what we need to do is optimize them for a therapeutic context. And so that really gives us, and what really we then do with machine learning is we're able to aggregate that knowledge of this privileged chemistry at a scale that was never at industrial scale, so that we actually do that. We can then score these molecules for all their drug-like properties using machine learning models. And then what we've done is build precision matching generalizable models that enable us to precision match to the biology that's needed to go at the underlying pathophysiology of disease, the best chemistry, right, to modulate that biology potently and specifically with all the characteristics to make it a great drug. And in many ways, you can kind of say it's back to the future, right? This is kind of how medicine started, through trial and error, antifungals, antibiotics, but we had to do it one at a time, right? One chemistry, one molecule at a time. What's magical about computation is we're able to actually do this matching at industrial scale. So we can take any pathway and find that precision matched optimal chemistry to what the biology needs. And that's what drives both the efficiency and then this potential for safety. And there are 40 plus chronically dosed FDA approved medicines that come from this space. We just use machine learning and AI to do that over and over more predictably.
Yeah, no, this is an exciting time. I think it's definitely the rate of drug development is getting faster and faster. And hopefully that would translate to cheaper drugs. So what you mentioned about the flagship work, so that's translate to what you're doing now? Or is like the flagship is more like where a lot of the thinking is happening, and then as company got, technology got spun up from there, and that's where it got started?
Yes, what flagship is a serial company innovator. Mm-hmm. And so they've created over 100 companies, including Moderna and many other companies that I'm sure you know well. Every company that they create starts with a fundamental scientific premise, like the one we started with. You then test and trial it. Once that's proven and you begin to scale it, it becomes a company. So Montai spun out from this development process that we developed the core concept. And now it's a company on its own. So we're a Series A, and we're actually raising our Series B right now. And, you know, we're rapidly scaling a pipeline of therapies going towards the clinic. And so it's really exciting to see both proving out that this is possible to aggregate the world's largest understanding of human qualified chemistry, these anther molecules, and to build these generalizable models to do the precision matching. Mm-hmm. And then we actually can then validate that we have, for a wide variety of biology targets, right, a super high quality set of advancing assets that really demonstrate the power of the platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thanks for clarifying that one. And so having run company in the fintech and also in retail and now here in the life science or healthcare, what are the similarities that you can bring that you think that it stays and something that you kind of have to leave behind?
Yeah, I think there, you know, you mentioned the regulatory piece. You know, financial services is also a heavily regulated industry in a different, you know, and there are some similarities and some differences. You know, I think what is persistent is the most important piece that I've seen to these companies being successful. I think the first is you lay out a bold vision of how you're trying to transform the business model to gain, you know, step change efficiency. And then how do you break that problem down to make it efficiently solvable and provable, right, in chunks? Because anytime you're trying to create a new model for how something is done, the biggest challenge is not hard to envision that future. The hard part is actually bringing it down into sub pieces, right? And that's something we had to do, you know, at Google a lot, right? We knew that we wanted to create an alternative to linear television, right? But you couldn't just do that in one step. Mm-hmm. We had to start with actually redefining what it meant to watch content, right? And that shorter form, less highly produced, non-appointment content was actually a better, a more interesting way for consumers to engage, right? And then we could scale from there. And so in this case, right, we have a really bold long-term vision for how we think we could treat chronic diseases. And we've broken that down into ways in which we can create learning and network effects in the way we think about. So the more chemistry we aggregate and the more pathways we go after, the more efficient and effective we are. And so there are really strong network effects like we got in other areas of technology. I think that is a thought process that is relatively newer in this area. How do you really create a learning flywheel that enables you to get smarter with every piece of chemistry, every pathway that you pursue? And everything in our company is digitized end to end. So every piece of data flows back into the system and generates, right, a greater form of knowledge. We also are highly efficient at bringing data from other industries. So I think something we do really well in technology companies is we scaffold off the knowledge that others have done. And you really focus in on what are the things that you really need to build yourself versus where can you scaffold off of others. Mm-hmm. And so we're very efficient at saying, what do we need to be best in the world at? How do we get there as quickly as possible? And, you know, build off of other, you know, knowledge centers. For example, in predicting, we are able to decode the structural language of chemistry and understand all those biological properties. As we do that, right, we want to be absolutely best in the world, that precision matching of chemistry on the bioactivity side. But there are other people that have done a lot of work on ADMET modeling or other types of things. We can scaffold off that foundation and then customize it for this highly diverse chemistry that's typically not represented in those models. And so we can then get there much faster and more efficiently. So we think about that. And I think that's a very well-honed, you know, approach that we use in other industries. I think we also really think culturally a lot about how do we blend the best of the technology thinking with the best of biology. And so building an organization that actually knows how to drive that flywheel requires, these are two schools of thought that are totally different, right? Technology is fast learning cycles, hack something together, iterate quickly, right? Daily, weekly, right? Sprints. Whereas this is a very artisanal process in traditional drug development led by very exacting scientists at each step in the process who all have highly specialized skills. And how do you actually build an organization where those two things can coexist at each step in the process? And so we really, and having done this in other industries, you need a glossary, right? What is the shared way we define things? Yeah, even within the scientific community, it's hard often to use the same language, which is something I quickly discovered when I came in. But how do we create this common language? How do we actually use those differences as a strength? So when the scientists realize, wow, so if I got this version and it didn't work for my needs, they can give me a new one in a week or 2 days or an hour. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden they get excited about the possibility. That feedback is so immediate, right? They're not used to that. So how do you actually create these teaming at each one of these critical decision points and enable, right, us to integrate much more thinking from the beginning. So we don't have to do everything in a sequence. We can create new integrated team-based problem solving that breaks through a lot of historical boundaries. And so that building of the two cultures so that you know, 1 + 1 = 4, right, is one of, I think, the most important arts in creating these next generation companies, because you need that exacting knowledge of those scientists and all those different disciplines. But when you supercharge them, which is how we think about it, it's not about the technology, it's about how do we supercharge them to make them even more efficient. They should be in control of that decision-making. They should understand how the AI is enabling them. How do we create visualization tools that don't make it a black box, where they're able to understand how do these models actually work? And that enables them to help us, you know, drive the innovation process.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So how do you bring the two cultures in together? Because the scientists probably feel like, we've been doing this for years. We know what we're doing. Here we're a bit slow, but we get it right. And then the technology was like, God, you're too slow. This is the way to do it. And how do you bring them together? And how do you make them communicate and trust each other?
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, as I said, that beauty and that trust-based blending is where you unlock transformation. I think it's first that you hire people that are committed to the overall mission, people who really want to get these safer therapies that are highly effective, that can transform the treatment of these diseases. Because when you all share that goal and want to think differently, that opens the mind to new possibilities. So you hire for mission, right, as well as skill. You also hire for people that want to be part of doing it differently. And I think that's really important. So we have very values-driven hiring. So Monty actually means climbing mountains with AI. And what we have is great expedition behavior. And we have a set of values that then aligns to that. And we really screen for that when we're hiring people in terms of that mental agility, that commitment to reimagining and being open to that. I think the second piece is the way we run our company day to day. So we have something we call like the task chain, where there's these key moments of cross-functional decision-making and also learning. So we have really clear learning loops for how we improve everything. And once people sit through that process a couple of times, it's amazing how people just quickly adapt. I mean, it's exciting for them. They're used to just saying, for example, this is my result, instead of saying, oh, but hang on, if I had 10 of those, right, what does that infer? And also by having everything in the process digitized, the scientists' work is so much easier, because if they look at something other under a microscope, it's automatically digitized, analyzed. And so when they operate in that kind of system, they realize how useful it is, right, to have that data and total traceability and the ability to go back and compare. And then the third thing we do is we do lunch and learn. So we have different areas of the company that are presenting to each other what they do, how they do it, how they think about it. And that creates this cross-functional learning. And, you know, we find that there's 100% attendance at these lunch and learns because everybody wants to learn how do the other pieces work. And by doing that, you build up this culture of learning and curiosity and interest in these other areas. So those are just a few of the examples of how we do it.
And how big is the company? I mean, how many people are working?
Yeah, we have over 50 people today. So we're still a relatively small company, but big enough, you know, that you really need to hone these processes to ensure that everybody is like operating as one integrated team.
Right. Because I think you do need to solidify the culture before you start growing even bigger.
Correct.
And so when you're talking about digitizing, there's a lot of some pieces cannot be digitized, I assume, or is everything is digitized?
For us, everything is digitized. Yeah. every experiment, every piece of data is all digitized and connected.
And is it because the capability, the technology is available already? Or why is it other companies don't do that? I guess that's my question.
They do not today, but that is the mindset, right, of coming at this with a fresh eyes and building the company from the ground up, is you can build these practices so that you have full end-to-end digitization and these clear learning loops. And you need a modular infrastructure. You need a lot of pipelines and other things built so that this is very efficient. But the workload reduction for people is tremendous. It just makes you much more efficient as a company. And again, you have full data traceability, which is also super helpful when it comes to things like IND filings or, you know, other efforts. And so for us, you know, every person's time is highly valuable. And so our focus is on how do we make this as efficient as possible. And it wasn't logical to some of the scientists originally because they weren't used to, you know, using some of these tools. But when they then see the benefit for them and their work of immediately having the analysis done or the data visualization capabilities, it's so powerful for them because they get to spend their time thinking and interpreting and learning and planning and not, you know, doing some of the more mundane activities, right, that were often consuming their time.
As I think it's the whole idea about digitization, it definitely saved a lot of the time of doing unnecessary work. I was talking to a friend today about, you know, during my time when you apply for a college application, you write an essay, you have to do type it up, and then somebody has redlined it, and you have to retype it, and then somebody redlined it. But now you just, everything happened instantly. So it gives you room, more time to do more important things.
That's it. And I think that, you know, digitization in this industry has many purposes, and we need to be very purposeful about where we do that. And the first things we digitized, we're really focusing on how do we reduce workload on the team so they have more time to think, right? If all the data comes back immediately, fully digitized from your CRO, so it's very easy to do that analytic quickly and efficiently, it saves a lot of time. And it really is transformational. But, you know, you need a team that knows how to set up those data pipelines and create the standardization of the workflows and other things. And, you know, again, people need to see real demonstrable value from doing that. And, you know, that's how you bring people along.
And you do need to have a good architect to kind of set it all up, correct?
And that's why I think it's much easier in many industries, right, for the new players, the digitally native players, where you build that into the company from day one. And that's just the way you do it. It's much harder to go back and redo that, you know, later. And so I think committing to that in our case, right, our company shouldn't exist, right, unless we're really good at that, right? That is our value to the world, is we are creating this enormous learning network efficiency. And so for us, it's existential. Right. For other companies, when you're evolving, it's hard to make that commitment because the way you do it does work. Right. And so you need to see transformational benefit to do it. But when you are, right, the innovator, right, it's existential. So you do it because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Right.
I'm just thinking about it's like you're building a brand new house versus remodeling.
That's it.
A big old house.
Right. And you always discover things when you're remodeling the old house.
Yeah.
that you didn't realize, right? That, oh, wait, that pipe isn't really where it's supposed to be. Or whoops, they, you know, that's actually a load-bearing wall, you know? Right. And there's a lot of issues about your data structure and your data processes that can sometimes make it very difficult and expensive to make those conversions. Whereas if you build that in today's more modern technology infrastructure, the modular design of the infrastructure, that makes it very easy to adapt it over time. So your entire platform is not going to get outmoded, right? It's always adaptable. And you need that because you want to do different kinds of modeling where you source from different types of data over time. And you need that to be incredibly efficient.
And so I have two last questions because I know I'm short on time here. You work in FinTech and you work also in Mattel. And the people who work in that organization, being a large organization versus a 50 organization, it's different. They tend to have a different personality. And how do you lead them? Do you lead them differently, or it's kind of, well, it's a company, it's a company.
Yeah, I think people are different. You know, these companies are different. I think a larger organization where, as you said before, you have legacy. One of the most important things when you're driving a transformation is you need to respect the past actively to get to the future. So whether it was Mattel or Ancestry, right, or Discover when I was turning that company around, you know, there is so much wisdom in the things that have been tried. But what you need to break through is sometimes people said, oh, I've already tried that, you know, and they can't then see the future. And so in those cases, you really have to paint that story of the future, but then you have to actively manage through some of the baggage from the past so that they can see that this truly is a possibility, right? That could be transformational. And the way in which you combine those new teams and do that together is where the accelerant happens. Because if people feel like, oh, there's this new way and I'm the old way, then you end up with a lot of tensions there that are not productive, right? Nobody wins in that scenario. So how do you do it together? I think when you're building a new company from scratch, you have a different set of challenges, which is people are coming from all the places that they came from. And no matter who and how good you are, you bring that baggage with you, right? The experiences you had, the way you did things. And in that case, it's really about painting that story of the future and then together creating a new way that we all build together. And it's taking that collective wisdom from all those experiences and actually enabling that to be activated to that new company to go further faster. And so the empowerment is a little bit different, right? It's you have to provide the initial set of structure, and then you have to activate. And this is what we talk a lot about in technology companies, the horizontal velocity. So you depend a lot more. So I sit with my director teams and my frontline teams at least once a month, and I do a deep dive with them because they know what's working and what's efficient and what's not efficient. And my job is to empower them to see those issues and just fix them, not wait for somebody at the senior level to see the data coming up and then ask, mm-hmm. right? So how do you empower your frontline to quickly let you know where there's lack of clarity or lack of things defined, push that up, let your mid-layer leaders constantly improve that, right? So that you're getting better, and then only deal with the big stuff at the top so that the senior people are leading heads up, as I say, versus heads down. And you're really depending on much more of that middle layer cross-functionally, which is very different than you would see in a traditional pharma where you'd have everything going up in different silos and then things getting aggregated at the top. You gain velocity in the company by having that momentum pushing up. And I think that is why, you know, technology companies are able to move so much faster, the super high-performing ones, because that is how they lead.
And do you think also the culture allows them to do that more? Or do you, I mean, why is that? Like a healthcare company, you don't see that as much.
I think, again, it goes back to when you have incumbent practices and processes, and then you want to redefine those in a new digital future. Mm-hmm. People are embedded in the way they've done things. And so you have to then unstick that and show them the value of a new approach. And so mm-hmm. the art there is how you sequence that in a way that people see progress quickly for the effort they're putting in, and you don't try to make it too complicated in the beginning, right? You help them come with you. Whereas in the brand new company, you get to define the way you do that against an absolute maxima. In that small company, your bigger issue is you have many fewer resources. So you have to pick how you chase that bigger goal so that you're able to see return rate and constant improvement. So we tend to focus on every month, right? Every quarter, on what did we get measurably much, much better at. And that creates that horizontal velocity underneath, because those people are saying, what do we have to do this quarter? What are the three things that if we can make velocity, the whole thing spins faster? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. Last question. I've been asking a few of my guests lately is, what are the things that other people value but you don't value?
Interesting. I guess as a leader, I value everything that my team values. So I wouldn't necessarily say that I think that there's a big difference there. If you're talking about within my own team, you know, I think one of the biggest important things that leaders need to do in a small company, because I'm both an investor also in my life as well as running this company. And I think that you need to be able to take input from a lot of stakeholders, from your investors, from your partners, from others, but no one else is running the company. And so you have to filter all that and make sure that you're relentlessly focused on what you know that you uniquely do for the world and why that's great. And you have to be comfortable that not everyone is going to understand what you're doing if you really believe it. And you have principle-based, fact-based reasons, right, for those beliefs. Now, the minute you have contrarian facts, you have to be willing to shift position. But mm-hmm. as long as the facts continue in that direction, and I think that's one of the most important things that I realized at Google, is that you have to be willing to be misunderstood, often for a significant period of time. So when we launched the first Android phone, that made no sense to anyone else except us, mm-hmm. right? When we launched the Chrome browser, right? If you weren't inside the company, it wasn't obvious why that was a existential and enabler, right? Why did Google do YouTube the way it did for a long period of time? You know, you have to keep your own compass. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be very difficult. You have to listen, you have to be responsive, but you also have to make those really hard choices. The biggest risk in a small company is not staying focused and not gaining mm-hmm. velocity on that focus.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how do you gain that compass?
I think it's through principle-based thinking. What is my story of the future? Why do I believe it? Right? I know that fundamentally, if we can create a predictable way to create small molecule medicines for as many pathways as possible, right? If I can get DCs declared in 12 to 18 months that have the highest probability of biology engagement and safety in humans, right? That is something that is really great for the world. And I have to stay focused on what am I doing to be able to do that. Now, there's a lot of people that would say, well, why don't you go to this indication? Why don't you focus on those targets, right? These things are really hot right now. And we have a certain understanding of our network and where we build network velocity across our chemistry and biology. They don't understand that, right? Because they're not inside of these machine learning networks. But we know that. And so we have to be willing, right, to stay focused, stay the course. Right. And as long as we're delivering against those milestones.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for sharing your insight. And it's really your lessons learned. I learned a lot from our conversation today.
And well, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, I'm so excited about the work you do at the Rosenman Institute to support so many amazing entrepreneurs.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.